So, my dear friends, a short meditation, if you kindly close your eyes. And then please focus on your nostril and simply be mindful of your breath as you inhale and as you exhale, just this much. And if your attention strays, compassionately, lovingly, bring it back to your nostril and simply be present as you inhale and as you exhale. And now, when you're ready, let go of this. And this time, please bring your attention to rest on your physical heart. Yes, our physical heart, which has been yearning, thirsting, aching to connect with us. Just simply awareness of your heart. And then if it pleases you, take one hand or both hands and put it over the heart, and through the palms of your hand, with your consciousness, embrace your heart. Connect physically with your heart. Feel your heart. Settle, go deep, as it were, with your consciousness into your heart. And one good way is by simply becoming aware of the beat of your heart. Can you be mindful of the beat of the heart and just connect with that in your own way, bonding with the rhythm of the heartbeat? Thank you. And now, my friends, as you connect with your heartbeat, with your heart, listen to this beautiful revelation that came to the Prophet Muhammad in a dream, where God, Spirit, Divinity, whatever your faith system allows, God tells each one of us, O beloved one, God says, I cannot be contained, I cannot be contained in the space of the earth, I cannot be contained in the space of the heavens, but I can be contained in the space of the pure, loving heart of my devotee. Just be with the mystery that God is outside of us and also inside of us, in our heart. The space of the heart is actually boundless, infinite. Divine heart is inside human heart. Just be with that astonishing mystery. And now, in this boundless space of the heart, please plant words of beauty with feeling, in humility, with sincerity. Sufis say words like, please help me. Please help me. I need help. I surrender to you. And or, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm so grateful. And especially in this Sufi meditation, the words, I love you, I really love you, or please help me to love you, and or whatever words feel right to you that resonate within you, unabashedly, no matter how awkward it might initially feel, plant those words inside the boundless heart space again and again and again and again. You can never overdo this. Please help me. I need help. I surrender to you. Thank you. I am so grateful. I love you. Please help me to love you. Anything else, keep on repeating it again and again with feeling, in humility, with sincerity. And as you keep saying those words, a divine vibration filled with love, blessings, healing, empowerment, transformation is going from the tongue into the mouth, into the throat, into the chest, deep into the heart, even deeper into what is called the hidden, and then even deeper into the hidden of the hidden, amazingly loving us, blessing us, healing us, empowering us, transforming us. and I'll stop saying anything at all. And as I count numbers ever so gently, coming into awareness. Number one, slowly, easily, gently coming into awareness. Number two, being open to this beautiful divine vibration of love and blessings and healing, empowerment flowing through you from head to toe. Number three, feeling grateful for this infusion of divine spirit. Number four, becoming aware that we are the beloved of the beloved. All is perfectly well, no matter how it seems. And number five, at your convenience, ever so gently opening your eyes. Take your time, please.
See you in me.
Thank you for that beautiful music, beautiful singing. You know, in the Islamic spirituality, Rumi says, music is the sound of the spheres. And we have been part of this harmony before. And all this piano music, singing, treble, bass, it really keeps our remembering fresh. My friends, today I wanted to focus on just this one sentence. There comes a time in our lives. There comes a time in our lives when we want to break out of this hypnotic trance, the way we are living. Life must have more meaning, more juice, more flavor. In other words, there comes a time when we really start to live by becoming a seeker. Now, I think you're familiar with Rumi, 13th century sage Rumi, am I right? Wonderful, okay. So Rumi says there are two veils that stand in the way of us becoming a seeker. What are those two veils? Health and wealth. When my health is good, health of my loved ones, or if I have wealth, not just money, also emotional security, all this talk about transforming the ego, opening up the heart, being of service, is not only irrelevant, it's very, very inconvenient. Until inevitably, one of those veils will shatter. Parents will die. Divorce. Plans that didn't work out. Then deeper questions. What is going on? Why me? But most of all, and this is a Quranic insight, in the Quran it says, this is the stage you come to when you really become a human being. You begin to, from within you, have this question or this insight, I need help. I really need help. But I need help from somebody or something greater than a human being or a human institution. Because you are unmindful, usually it's a crisis. That's why another wonderful poet I love, Hafiz, 14th century poet Hafiz, he has his wonderful poetry, says, this is what leads to us becoming a true seeker. Something missing in my heart tonight, something missing in my heart tonight has made my eyes so soft, my voice so tender, my need for God absolutely clear. So it can be a singular event. It can be a series of events, not just necessarily sad, could be very joyous, but really it awakens us, makes us ask deeper questions. So for example, let's take the example of Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi. You know, he was a very timid person, very unsuccessful person. And he was in total despair. He said, I'm good for nothing. The first time he stood up to prosecute a case or defend a case, he forced himself to become a lawyer. He became so nervous, he blacked out, he became unconscious, and everybody laughed. He felt so shamed. So what made him a seeker? He came across a verse from the Bhagavad Gita which said, truth is God. Just that one small sentence, like Rumi would say, splashed in his chest. It resonated. And he focused his entire life on this sentence, truth is God. All I have to do is be truthful and live the truth and become the truth. So that was one singular event. A lot of other events also. In the case of Rumi, he met his teacher, Shams-e-Tabriz, who opened up his heart. And when his heart opened up, he began to hear amazing voices and words from the other side. And he would go into a trance and utter them. And the collection of that is the poetry of Rumi. In the case of the Buddha, what awakened him? It was a question he had in his mind. which really went deep inside of him. The question was, why would a mother want to give birth to a child who would grow old, fall sick, and die? It makes no sense. It was a question which led him on a 7-year journey to find answers. It was a question that finally made him go deep within himself, and answers came out in the form of Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. But it was a question. What was in your case? What event or events, happy or sad, in the timeline of your life made you shift, turn in a different direction? Just be with that. There comes a time in your life when you also realize, you know, this question of faith, it cannot be grounded just in belief or hearsay. This is very important in Sufism. There comes a time when you realize there has to be more than just hearsay. Rumi says, you begin to move from what is called borrowed certainty, to an inner knowing. So I wanted to put in here a story of the mullah. Mullah is a fictional character in Islamic spirituality through whom many truths are conveyed. He's like a sage and a village idiot rolled into one. And he's very happy to laugh at himself. And through that, he really conveys some very profound truths. So here's the story of the mullah. Somebody knocks on his door. It's his friend, and he has brought with him some wild ducks he has hunted. And together they make a very large, tasty pot of duck soup. And they really enjoy the duck soup. But the next day, and the next day, and the next day, there's always a knock on the door. I'm a friend of the friend of the friend who brought you the ducks. So Mullah says, welcome, 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 sit down. The rules of hospitality, feeds him the duck soup. On the 10th day, again, I'm a friend of the friend of the friend of the friend of the friend who brought you the ducks. By this time, the mullah is annoyed. The guest is sitting there. The mullah goes to the kitchen and just brings some hot water. And the guest is ready. He begins to taste. He says, this is not duck soup. This is just hot water. This is, it's not duck soup. He says, no. This is the soup of the soup of the soup of the soup of the soup. The point is, many of our beliefs are based on a soup of the soup of the soup of somebody else's hearsay. So there comes a time we really become filled with hope. And we need hope. The Quran has some verses. It says, you know, the earth, very metaphorically, the earth was parched, but the waters of mercy came down and the earth became clothed in green. It is God who sends down rain, says the Quran, when humankind has lost all hope and God unfolds its grace. Rumi has this verse. He says, oh dear heart, dear heart, never lose hope. Miracles dwell in the invisible. Miracles dwell in the invisible. Even if the whole world has turned against you, keep your eyes on the friend, with a capital F. And the Quran, and you know, has certain insights. It says that particularly in times of despair, never give up hope, but do two things, it says. And I'll quote Rumi. He says, number one, be in regular attendance at the divine court. Be in regular attendance at the divine court. And number two, never give up on doing little acts of service that you do, particularly in times of despair. Those two things, being in regular attendance at the divine court and doing little acts of service, particularly in times of affliction, magically open up doors. So I'd like you just to be with that for a little bit. How does that apply to my life? Okay, let me move on. There comes a time when we really have this inspiration, this urge to become a better human being, to become more Christ-like, Buddha-like, Allah-like, Krishna-like, Elohim-like. There comes a time when we say we want more meaning in life. So let me ask yourself, in my life, and this is in two stories, both in Sufism and Buddhism, let me take the Buddhist version, am I aspiring for the real gem in my life? So here's a story of the Buddhist monk. As you know, monks are always, in Buddhism, always focused on service. They have no time to cook, but they go to different householders, dwellings, and they beg for food, and the householder is so happy to give the food because they'll gain merit. So there's one particular monk, knocks on a door. It happens to be the house of a jeweler. Of course, they're very happy to bring food, and as the jeweler brings food and the monk opens up his small sparse pouch, the jeweler is stunned. Why is the jeweler stunned? Because in the sparse pouch is a precious stone. He says, I'm a jeweler. You know that stone you have, that large stone? It's like worth, you know, $5 million. Where did you get it? And, you know, the monk has what Buddhists call equanimity. He says, I kind of remember a disciple gave it to me, 5 years ago. And then the monk suddenly says, do you want it? Of course not. I can never have it. It belongs to you. He says, the monk says, I know. Because it belongs to me, I'm choosing to give you this precious stone. Gives it, and the monk goes away. And now the jeweler is so happy, exhilarated. His life has changed, life of his children, life of his grandchildren. But now the questions in his mind, should I tell my wife about this? Well, of course, she's my wife. I love her. But my wife has a sister who is very gossipy. The whole village will know. Should I not? Should I hire guards? Of course I must hire guards. This is so precious. But if I hire guards, people will know I'm hiding something precious. Should I not? Should I tell IRS about this or not? Yes or no? He cannot sleep a wink. Should I not? Should I not? On the 10th day, an insight strikes him. He grabs that jewel and he runs in search of the monk and finally catches up with the monk and says, Monk, please take this gem back, but give me the real gem. The real gem? He says, yes, I realize the real gem is the ease, the peace with which you are able to give me this precious stone. That is the gem I really aspire to in my life. So ask yourself, this is called, can I go from form to essence? In my life, am I striving for form or am I striving for essence? It can determine the quality of your life from A to Z. You know, the mullah, this fictional mullah, has many grave sites. There's one in Turkey. And even in his death, he's always imparting wisdom. So if you approach his tomb, it's a grand tomb, and you approach his gravesite, you'll find there's a huge, large, forbidding door with chains around it, keys and padlocks all around it, but there are no walls around that tomb. And there's an inscription there by Rumi, and the words are, no matter what titles you acquire, no matter how many riches you accumulate, the thief will come from the unguarded side. Therefore, invest in that, focus on that which can never be stolen. Love, compassion, justice, beauty. So again, just be with that. It's an important question in my life. What am I aspiring for? So my friends, there comes a time when we want to really get close to that which is called indescribable, inconceivable, unutterable. In fact, there's a beloved female saint, most beloved female sage saint in Islam named Rabia, who cried out, "There is a disease in my breast. There is a disease in my breast no doctor can cure. There is a disease in my breast no doctor can cure. Only union with that friend can cure it." Or consider the exclamation of Rumi, who says, "There is a kiss we want. There is a kiss we want all our lives. A touch of spirit on the body. There's a kiss we want all our lives. A touch of spirit on the body." And what a paradox, this invisible, whatever you call it, God, spirit, unknown. Where is it? You see, there's a verse in the Quran that says, where God says, "We are closer to you than your jugular vein." There's a true story of a very famous Islamic spiritual teacher, a Sufi teacher, in 8th century in Basra, Iraq. And he was telling his congregation of students, "God is very merciful. God is very compassionate. Just keep on knocking and knocking and knocking on the door of God, and one day the door will open." And Rabia was passing by, and she heard that, and she turned to the Sufi master and said, "Brother, when was the door ever closed?" And the teacher stood up and just bowed to her. Why do bad things happen to good people? Is God really compassionate? I'm asked this very often. You know, you talk so much about God. Look at what is happening around the world. You know, there's no answer to this. It's a great mystery. But for me, as someone who has worked with people in pastoral counseling also, to me there's a greater mystery. I have dealt with people who've come to me and said, "You know, I'll do therapy with you on one condition. Never mention the word God." And these are people who have been so savaged by life circumstances, incest. One lady, I remember, her daughter was murdered. Another person was from Africa, whose father was an important opposition leader. He was thrown off a helicopter. So, you know, we did lots of work. Never once did I mention God. And they're the ones who did all the real work. But what is amazing is after they had done the work of recovery, of completion meaning it's an ongoing work, but they had done the work of integration and healing, these same people today are the most ardent, passionate lovers of God. Whenever I meet them, I always want to go away. Why? Because the only thing they talk about is God, 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 God. There's a wonderful, in Urdu, there's a language called Urdu in Pakistan. I'm from Bangladesh. It used to be one country before it split up. There's a verse, a very famous Sufi verse. Allah hame Allah walo se bachaye. Allah hame Allah walo se bachaye. Meaning, it works for this particular group. Oh God, please God, God, save me from all these God lovers. You know, if I want to summarize this, there's also a true story of a Bedouin. Time has passed. Who was asked, "Do you believe in God?" And the Bedouin said, "You mean that God who sent me afflictions, illnesses, poverty, made me wander from country to country to country, but as he spoke, he entered into a state of ecstasy?" So God is a fantastic paradox. Prayer, there comes a time when you really are serious about prayer and meditation. There is meditation and there is meditation. See, so let me just quickly, looking at the time, summarize what Rumi has said about the practice of silence. There's no such thing as a Muslim silence, Jewish silence, Christian silence, Hindu silence. It's all silence. But there is silence and there is, as I said before, silence. So Rumi says, silence is not the absence of sound. Silence is not the absence of sound. It is the absence of the little self. Silence is the language of God. Silence is the language of God. Everything else is a poor translation. So Rumi says, be silent, be silent, be silent, so that the Lord who gave you language may speak. Jamal, be silent, so that the Lord who gave you language may speak. For as he fashioned a door and a lock, for as he fashioned or she fashioned a door and a lock, God also made a key. God also made a key. You know, once the Buddha was telling his congregation, when he was being asked about the benefits of meditation, what have you gained from meditation? What can one gain from silence? And the Buddha said, nothing at all. And they were so thunderstruck. They said, why are you making us, you know, meditate 3 hours a day? He said, but let me tell you what I have lost in meditation. I've lost my fear, my anxiety, my depression, my fear of old age, my fear of death, and so on and so forth. So there comes a time we are present with our spiritual practices. There comes a time when we really are of authentic service to others. You know, this is a story in many traditions where people say, people have gathered and they say, you know, oh God, you know, look around you. There is so much of suffering, so much of pain. Why don't you do something? Why do you allow this, God, for all this cruelty, oppression, suffering? So the story is of a very pious person who travels to different countries and is absolutely heartbroken by, you know, what he or she sees, so much of pain everywhere, so much of injustice, suffering. And finally, one midnight, is a time of war, sees this little orphan child shivering in the midnight, covered with sores, dying, and he breaks down and cries, God, please do something, do something, do something. And that night he has a vision. God says, beloved one, I did do something. I created you. So there comes a time when I realize, am I doing what I can do in my family, in my community, in my country? Let me at least do my part. Rumi says, in whatever circle you are, be a lamp. Be a lifeboat. Be a ladder to others. And I'm a Bengali from Bangladesh. There's a wonderful Bengali poet named Tagore, who was the first Asian to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. And you know, the insight is, you have no idea of the joy that the soul feels in being of authentic service to others. So his verse is, I slept and dreamt that life was joy. I slept and dreamt life was joy. I awoke and found life was service. I slept and dreamt life was joy. I awoke and found life was service. I served and lo, service was joy. So just be with that service. Very quickly, two other quick points. One is, there comes a time we realize the beauty, the majesty, the essential need for community. I'll never forget in my ministry a few years ago, I've written about that. Whenever I would speak, I would see a lady coming in, very shy. It's almost like she wanted to tell me something. And when my sermon was over, I could sort of sense she's there, wants to speak, but then she would disappear. But one day, when she did come, she came up to me and said in a very, very shy way, can you help me build community? And then in the meantime, before she could finish what she was saying, somebody came and hugged me, and I said, thank you so much, I'm so glad you're here. I turned around, she was gone. But I remembered her name. Many weeks later, maybe some months later, not too long, I read something in the newspaper. Her name is there, and I knew where she lived. She told me where she lived, which area. They said that they found a dead body in the bedroom of this house, lying there unattended for 2 or 3 weeks. And it really struck me, the critical need for community. You know, the biggest problem, you know, all this Pew research, and there's been study at Harvard and one by Brigham Young University, the biggest killer, the biggest pain, you know, is not this or that disease, it's loneliness. You know, Rumi says, a wall standing alone is useless. Add to it other walls, it can support a roof, even a granary. Only when ink joins with a pen can the blank paper say something. And so Rumi says, please, please, come out of the circle of time and enter the circle of love. Create community. Okay, I'm seeing that my time is finishing, so I should end with a story of a time. Time about time. Let's see. There's a wonderful, famous story of the mullah who travels everywhere. He's in London Museum. And here is this famous guide, a professor. He says, this is 5,000 years old. Mullah says, excuse me, it's 5,004 years old. The guide is annoyed a little bit. This is 50,000 years old. Excuse me, it's 50,004 years old. Happens a third time. This is like 100,000 years old. Excuse me, says the mullah, is 100,004 years old. Now he's really annoyed. He says, sir, you have a turban, you have a beard. I know you come from the mysterious East, but how can you be so laser precise about these dates? Yeah, that's what it is, an answer. And the answer is, the mullah said, simple. I was here 4 years ago. At that time, you mentioned those dates. So what is this story about? It has every mullah story has many levels of meaning. It's later than you think. And my last word about that is all the traditions say there comes a time, just become very aware of the beauty of passing away. If my eyesight is dimming, as it is as I'm getting older, if my back is bent a little bit more than usual, Sufis say it's only because you have no idea of the pain and sadness the soul feels in having been separated from the source. You have no idea of the joy the soul feels in going home. So Rumi has this wonderful story about, or poetry, you know, he never wrote, he just uttered, about death. He says, every death is very beautiful. I don't care what you say about what kind of death it was. And his words are, how marvelous was the way you quit the world. The way you ruffled your feathers and breaking free of your cage, you took off for your soul's world, a lovesick nightingale among owls. A lovesick nightingale among owls. You caught the scent of roses. A lovesick nightingale among owls. You caught the scent of roses and flew to the rose garden. So I will repeat one more sentence from Prophet Muhammad. He always was like to end his sermons or sometimes by saying that, you know, Jamal, when you arrived here, everybody around you was laughing and smiling, but you are crying and weeping. Live such a life. Live such a life that when you depart for the invisible world, everybody around you is crying and weeping, but you are laughing and smiling. Thank you so much. Thank you.